Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Ira Harris. He's independent trader, previous successful hedge fund manager, analyst, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003. Welcome, Ira.
Welcome, Richard. Glad to be here.
Great. So I thought maybe we have a discussion today on intermarket analysis and your perspective of where the four markets are going, namely the bond market, currency market, equity market, and commodity market, and perhaps looking at the factors that are affecting each, either from a technical perspective or a geopolitical perspective, and what your outlook is for those markets.
Sure. You know, let's see if we can confuse everybody.
Okay. Great. Yeah. And so maybe we begin with a view on the bond market and the currency market. Those two generally perceived to be the two key markets that determine everything else.
Sure. Let's discuss them and see what they're trying to tell us about the state of the world.
So do you think the interest rates, let's look at the U.S., interest rates are likely to go higher by the Fed on the short end of the curve, or and what is your view on the long end of the curve, and how does that all play into the U.S. dollar?
You know, it's just the question that has everybody scratching their heads and trying to figure out where we're at. It's right now. Right now, if you took where the world, if you looked at the, let's say the yield curve, because you and I, as long as we've been talking, at some point we always get back to the yield curve. So it's a very important level here, because here, we're just coming off a Fed meeting 50 minutes ago, in which they called the slowdown in the first quarter transitory, which means that they're not worried about it. And yet they made no mention at all. In fact, there's no change to the currency policy, to the current policy of maintaining the Fed balance sheet. So $4.5 trillion will remain at $4.5 trillion, and whatever expires will be renewed by the purchasing, whatever duration expires, they'll replace that with the new instrument, as far as we know. So that's what's going on. Now, with the Fed raising rates, as we've seen a rate rise in March, and we saw a rate rise, of course, in December. And everybody's talking about the robustness in the economy, even though GDP, you know, turned out to be low at 0.7. There are other elements that, of course, are slowing down. And right now, without the Fed doing anything, Fed has done nothing except raise rates. It's done nothing to the balance sheet. Well, if the Fed was looking to start unwinding its balance sheet, which would mean a dynamic act, not a passive act, but a dynamic act of actually starting to sell some of their assets, we would really, the first move would be for the curve to start to steepen, because a lot of potential buyers would step back and the market would say, okay, show me what you're going to be doing. And you're going to have others who are going to try to front run the Fed, because the Fed model says, well, this should be no problem. But forget the Fed model. What the Fed doesn't model is the effect of the marketplace. And they're hoping that the marketplace allows them to do this. This is a very important element in this. What the market decides, is it going to be cooperative? Will the market be cooperative to what the Fed wants to do, which is what the Fed is worried about? They won't admit it, but it's why they don't want to announce any pre-program, because it's like the problem the ECB has. A lot of people front run the ECB as they go in to buy the, now it's $60 billion a month in assets. So you could see them on a day and an interim basis of what they're doing at times, and the market tries to rush ahead of them, those who have access to it. With the Fed, if the Fed starts to unwind by an aggressive type of action, which is selling the debt because they want to unwind it in a quicker way. We don't know what they're going to do, so it's all conjecture at this point. The long end of the curve will go up higher than the short end in the immediate period, because the market will, again, race ahead of them. So we don't know, but the curve ought to be steepening in that environment. Right now it's not. In fact, the curve, with the Fed doing nothing but raising rates, the curve is actually flattened quite a bit. We have the 210 U.S. curve, which I call the investor's curve, not the speculator curve. It's at 101.5 this morning. You know, I think a month ago when we talked, we were up to 120, 121, 122 steepness. Now we're 101. And it's interesting in my perspective, how it just mirrors the German 210 curve. Even with negative rates in Germany, the yield curve in Germany is 104 positive. And these two, the U.S. and the German, just continually mirror each other. I'm not sure what that means, but I'm watching it because I find it more than a passing interest, because it's continued on for quite a while. But I can't tell you if the Fed doesn't unwind, you know, ultimately, if the Fed is too aggressive in unwinding the balance sheet, the curve, it of course will tip us into a very flattening curve, which will be, again, that'll fly in the face of what we all think should happen. But that was what happened when the Fed announced QE, if you remember. First, the curve steepened, and then it started to flatten dramatically, because the market went from sensing some hyperinflation, that's a severe exaggeration, from some type of real great stimulus with QE, to saying, hey, the Fed's in here. There's a bottom, or there's a top to the amount of yields because of the Fed aggressive action. And that's what happened. So the curve started to flatten back. I think we went out to a steep curve of 280 basis points and wound up coming in to about 150, 140 fairly dramatically. So there's going to be all kinds of things here, because the market is going to really set the tone. Unlike QE, which the Fed was able to control the market, I think that if the Fed were to actually embark upon an actual unwinding, that the market would then set the tone, and will be very, very interested to see. And if it deems that the Fed, you know, people have written about this, that if the Fed is that 100, I forgot who it was, excuse me, but he said 100 billion shrinkage is equivalent to 10 basis point interest rate rise. Well, that's conjecture anyway. We don't know that to be a fact, but we're going to find out. But right now, the curves are telling us that the Fed, right now, the curve, if I look at the curve without the Fed doing anything, with no announcements on the shrinkage of the balance sheet, the curve is telling me that the Fed is a little too aggressive here for the moment. I think Lacey Huntington has written about this from the Hosington Letter, that you have to be careful here. Because the curve is telling you that the Fed is moving too aggressively, and that's why the curve has been flattening of late. But it's a very good question, and the jury is out on what it means. So we will be patient with it.
What do you think of the idea that maybe the Fed is waiting to see if it sees accelerating inflation? One of the fund managers we follow with Dr. Albert Friedberg of the Friedberg Mercantile Group in Toronto. And he thinks the Fed will only act to reduce the balance sheet when it actually sees accelerating inflation. What do you think of that?
Well, I don't know, you know, and I have great respect for Al Friedberg. I mean, he's older than I am. We're about the same age, and I followed his work for as long as I've been trading. So, very good global macro guy. I'm not sure about that because I'm not sure how to look at accelerating inflation. Today, we had the Fed, Danielle Booth, I know who's a regular, she had it laid out very well on CNBC. If somebody would open up their ears and actually listen to what she had to say, but before the announcement, she said that's what they're going to say, is that the first quarter growth was transitory. Well, they love that word. Everything is transitory. Oil prices, transitory. So will they say I'm not sure what Al Friedberg says is that inflation number, if it's 3%, will they call that transitory? Will it be to one-off events? It's funny that Mario Draghi uses the exact same language. Last week's ECB meeting, or 2 weeks ago, he used the phrase transitory. We're looking at what happened in energy prices in Europe. That was transitory. Okay, yeah, I got it. I understand it. Everything's transitory. So I'm not sure. The Fed is not going to do this in a vacuum. If Marie Le Pen wins the election Sunday and throws the entire financial system into turmoil, then the Fed has to change their perspective too.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of things in play here. I'm not looking, I think that's a low probability, high impact event for her to win, to use the language of, the great Alan Greenspan, tongue in cheek, sorry. But I don't know. So will that force him to raise higher? I'm one who believes that Yellen will be very reticent to raise rates too quickly. I think she is, I'll say it again. She's a labor economist and she views the fact that wages have been so weak over a 25-year period that, if it was wage inflation catching up and wage inflation was coming out of – and increased wages were coming out of profits, I think she'd be very comfortable with that and that she wouldn't be so quick to act. So it all depends what type of inflation. Is it going to be wage inflation? What's going to be the driving force of it? Right now I'm not seeing it. So it's a very difficult question to say. I can't answer it. I truly can't answer it in any meaningful way because there's too many variables that are unknown and I don't know what's going to surround them. So I don't want to venture that, but I think the Fed is reticent right now to get too aggressive here. And I think they want to see more from Trump and Congress before they get aggressive. I think if you saw, even before you saw the inflation data, I think if you saw what was deemed to be truly an aggressive fiscal stimulus package, I think that would prompt the Fed to move regardless of where inflation was. Mm-hmm. And that's coming out of their mouth, with Yellen saying, it's really not important. It's not really needed to have a fiscal stimulus when we're at full employment. That resonates in my ear and I can't leave that because that says to me that she's watching very carefully about, fiscal policy. So to me, I can't answer it. I certainly respect Al Friedberg and I see why he would say that, but I can't go there.
I see. What about the consideration of other factors that may influence the bond market and the U.S. dollar? For example, like international capital flows coming from perhaps Europe and other places where there's more of an advanced state of financial crisis than in the U.S., sending dollars to the U.S. Also, we've talked in the past about central banks around the world buying assets in the form of equities, many on the stock, on the U.S. stock market, the Dow Jones. Are those still strong factors? And also, I guess, the corporate debt overseas, $9 trillion. you know, sort of the liquidity factor behind that and the demand for U.S. dollars?
They are huge factors. You know, as who was it who pointed out in his work, and it was a very good piece of work, that the first quarter, central bank buying around the world totaled $1 trillion in assets. Let me use that number again, just in case you miss it, $1 trillion in assets. The ECB, the BOJ, the Bank of England, and with the Fed, purchasing stuff that was expiring, and all the other central banks doing the same thing, it turned into $1 trillion the first quarter. Well, really, you're kind of surprised that global assets are levitating? Of course they're levitating. The amount of liquidity is huge. Now, I have not been wildly bullish the dollar. I think the dollar has all kinds of warts on it. But I, as we've talked about for as long as I've been doing FRA, and I have 40 years of doing this, that the dollar and all currency markets are all relative value plays. Because somebody's up and somebody's down. Or even if everybody is moderately up, some are doing better and they may offer a higher return. And there may be an opportunity for a higher return. But I think I'm one who thinks that the U.S. equity market is close to what we may discern as full value based on any historic metrics. So I don't make that in a fairly stable world. The U.S. is not where I would be chasing assets right now. You know, you and I talked in January. And what did I say? The Mexican peso and the Mexican stock market were probably the most undervalued asset class in the world. And you know what? Did pretty well in the last, you know, 3 or 4 months, because on a relative value play, it was. You know, the Trump administration had ad nauseum tried to, you know, to verbally abuse Mexico, and it was working. And then all of a sudden, people say, well, this is kind of crazy valuations, and we've seen that. So again, relative value play. A lot of people are pushing India as, you know, a great place to invest. Maybe, but I know that India has a lot of problems, infrastructure problems that are enormous, political problems too, that they're trying to work out, even though as strong as Modi may be. So let's scour the globe. I still think, if you ask me, what place do I think is the best place for investment right now, and it's very hard for me to say this, it would be Germany. Because if the Germans agree to do whatever it takes to hold the whole EU project together, well, Germany's in the catbird seat, and you'll experience some inflation in Germany, but the currency will be weak. But on the other hand, if things got so bad that the whole EU project basically blew apart, well, you're buying Germany with a low currency right now, the euro. And if Germany were to pull out for some reason, you know, we've talked about this, and this is a 3-hour show as far as I'm concerned. And we'll talk about the things that will take place. But German assets would convert to Deutschmarks, and that would be a very strong currency, and I would be very comfortable in that regard. You know, so one of the things I've been buying all year, and I'm not promoting it, it's just one of the things that I'm looking at, are like some of the ETFs, which I usually don't trade. But for the EWG, it provides me with a solid basis for investment in Germany, our German caps, with a nice dividend return. And, you know, and I'm actually out, you know, with other people looking at property. But property's been bid up pretty much, and I don't like to chase asset values, so I'll be patient. But those are places that I like. I don't see the U.S. really benefiting much more from inflows with people chasing assets. I think that the United States has been the recipient of it for 3 or 4 years, because they were 3 or 4 years ahead of the other developed part of the world, Japan, and certainly Europe, because it took Europe a long time, and they're still not out of the effects of the Great Crisis, because as we saw, with unemployment rates in Italy, Spain, Portugal, Greece, we can go on and on, are way too high. France, you know, France has 10% unemployment too. So they still have massive problems. So I want to go to the best of the best. And if it doesn't work out, I still wind up with the best of the best. And the Deutschmark would be a currency I would love to own outside of Europe. You know, and I'm not the only one who would think that way. Probably, as we've talked about, the Swiss National Bank would be very happy too, because it would take some of the natural pressure or the upward pressure off.
Yeah, so either scenario you're saying for Germany could be bullish on assets in Germany. Yeah.
Right. And even though you get the use of a weak currency. And why do I say it's a weak currency? Because, you know, I always watch the euro and can cite it in terms of the Deutschmark. And right now we're 1.79 on a synthetic basis for the Deutschmark. Mm-hmm. And the Deutschmark, when the euro came into being at 1.17 and change in January 1st, 1999, the Deutschmark was like 1.67. So I'm getting a cheaper currency with a much stronger economy. So, you know, I just look at it in that perspective. And in that perspective, it makes a lot of sense to me as I scour the world. This is not an easy world to invest in, because the political risks are phenomenally great. You know, we're not out of the – even if Macron wins the election on Sunday, which he's expected to do, you know, then we get on to other things. Italy is still a massive problem for Europe. Greece has not gone away, no matter the nonsense that they like to spin out of there. Japan, you know, I don't know if people know this, but the other day, a Japan JGB, which is a 10-year Japanese note, it didn't even trade. The world's second largest bond market, and there was no trade in the market.
Wow.
I mean, let's think about that. That's how when you want to look at how the central banks have absolutely destroyed the signaling mechanism of the bond markets, you don't have to look very far. It's all there to see. And you know what? It's kind of like Colin Powell's, you know, statement to George W. Bush in 2003. Well, if you go into Iraq, you break it, you own it. Well, I'll tell you what. Central banks have broken the global bond markets, and they're going to have to own up to it at some time. Now they may say that's great. We want to own it because now we can control it. And maybe that's what their goal is. But there's going to be a lot of answering to do at some point.
Could that be the end point for other central banks like the Federal Reserve? The point in time when there's no bid on treasuries at some point in the future?
You know what? I don't know. They may, the Fed may be too self-confident to believe that that's possible. But again, as I say, their models have no respect for market reaction. Everybody must repeat that to themselves. Those models do not take in and play the impact of the marketplace. And they think that they're going to be able to extract themselves with very little pain. As Ben Bernanke famously said the other day, you know, on the 3% bet, he says he'd bet the under on that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to tell you what, I would bet the over as far as market impact on Fed actions if they deem to shrink their balance sheet. They're going to find out the pent-up power of the market and its ability to cause them a lot of pain.
I guess for now, the power of global liquidity is big on the – if we move to a discussion on the equity market, you recently quoted the stock market is up more than 1% and the shorts have been abused for the past 4 weeks as politics, war, and whatever method of apocalypse have been laid out by the power of global liquidity and the promise of low taxes. The fundamentals of QE continue to provide the mainstay of investing. Do you still see that as the case?
Well, did I write that? It sounds too intelligent for me.
yeah, in the blog, yeah.
Yes, you know what? It has the ability to do that. You know what? And everybody keeps wondering, well, how can this market keep going up? I mean, it's the beginning of every conversation I have with intelligent investors. And people who are astute and pay attention and are aware of what's going on, it's the beginning of every conversation I have. And I, you know what? I laugh because we're all stuck in that bind. And everybody is stuck in that same situation of how do I deal with this? You know, blah, blah, blah. So we all want to know, but at the end of the day, again, a trillion and a quarter, you know, is a very significant amount of money. And it puts a lot of pressure on people. You know, there are people who have to invest out there every day, pension funds, insurance companies. Well, now we know the Swiss National Bank, the BOJ is, all these people are putting money to work. And of course they're having an impact because at the end of the day, interest rates aren't high enough to attract people to leave the comfort. And I use that term, we have to think about it, that these equity markets are a comfort zone. So interest, they won't let interest rates go high enough to start to ease some of that burden. And that means that people have to take comfort in the equity market. And I, you know, I'm one who believes that's a very dangerous scenario. You know, Minsky must be spinning in his grave that we've gotten to this point and it's so controlled by the central banks. The central banks have created a global Minsky moment. That's where we're at because everybody is complacent. Well, we haven't gotten to the Minsky moment yet. It's everything, you know, of course, approaching the Minsky moment because, again, you know, where else are you going to go? Gee, should I buy German two-year debt at negative 70 basis points today? Negative, whatever. For the average investor, that's not palatable. If you're an insurance company, you can't buy negative. You've got obligations that you have to meet. If you're, you know, if you're a pension fund, it's enough. As Daniel Booth writes regularly, you know, about the pension crisis that is coming. There is, Chicken Little. It's not Chicken Little. It exists out there. And the lower that interest rates stay for longer, the more they get, you know, as she rightfully talks about, the more they get behind the bogey. And that bogey is... It grows and grows and grows. And I don't know how they're going to get out of it. There is a cost to everything. Just because you don't see it today doesn't mean it's not going to pop up tomorrow. We know that, right? We know that. Just because it's not visible to you, God, I feel like I'm going back to the Wittgensteinian logical positive school. You know, with what that which you can picture, only that which is, you know, you can picture is reality. That everything else, you know, that which is ineffable is unknowable. And what's the big difference? Well, in the investment world, we tend to get locked into that mindset, but that can change very quickly. And you know, that's my point. And I think that the world is kind of sleeping through some things, but this is all the outcome of central banks not knowing when enough was enough, you know. Yeah. And then, hey, if we're doing this, it's working, yeah, keep doing it. You know, again, I'll be the first to say QE1 in the U.S. was absolutely needed. It was absolutely needed. I understood Draghi in July of 2012 that he had to stem that because it was going to break apart. And if your goal was to keep the EU and the euro together, you had to do something. But after QE1, you know what? You lose me because QE1 was done to prevent a mass liquidation of U.S. assets. I understand that. That was absolutely mandatory. And, you know, I could take the stance of others who say, well, let the liquidation take place because that's what helps capitalism and that's what capitalism is based on. Yes, but there is a political reality at some point. And if we would have gone into a 1930s type of action with mass liquidation of assets and possibly 20 to 25% unemployment, I fared the political outcome more than I feared QE1. So, you know what? We can have this argument. It's a long argument. I'm not doctrinaire anything, but I, you know, to me, that was the pragmatic approach. QE2 and QE3, I will take the absolute other side, totally unnecessary, and has created this mess that we are now in.
You've recently mentioned a look at the silver divided by copper ratio as having a correlation with the equity market. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I was on Monday. I was taking a good look at this because if you look at certain metal ratios, like gold, silver has been, the gold has been appreciating against the silver for the last 2 weeks significantly. This has been almost a 10% move in that relationship, while the equity markets have been holding up pretty strong. And usually the silver tends to outperform during periods of equity strength. The silver holds its ground, maybe outperforms, because silver has an industrial usage as well as, you know, as a currency usage, as a precious metal. Copper is, of course, you know, the metal with the PhD in economics, has a tendency to outperform the other metals when the equity markets are doing well, because people deem it as, well, the economy is doing well. It's a correlation that has been built by the algorithms that'll last for a short period of time. But outside of a short period trading period, I don't give it much credence. Unless you're at the start of a dynamic bull market in the equities and you want to, that I understand, but not at these types of levels. So the copper has outperformed silver dramatically during that same period, which is highly unusual, especially when the equity markets are holding. So I just was looking at that correlation, and it's corrected quite a bit since Monday, as silver has gone down, but copper has dropped almost. When I started looking at it, copper was trading 268. I'm looking at my screen right now, we're trading 250-240. So it's a fairly dramatic move. I'm not sure what it's telling me, but I am paying attention to it. Now, some people have written today about the copper, that the copper broken down because all of a sudden the Chinese are back in putting on copper hedges because, you know, the Chinese are very good at securitizing any asset that they hold, which is why it's hard sometimes to get a good reading on true supply-demand situation in any commodity market because of the use of commodities as security for loans in China. You know, they have gigantic warehouses sitting full of commodities. Well, are they being used? Yes. But the use, when they're used as securitization, really wreaks havoc on the commodity market, because when they're sitting in a warehouse as security, they're not necessarily being consumed. So, you know, when things start to slow down and soften and the prices start to drop on those commodities, then the lenders get nervous and they start calling some loans and start bringing that security to market. So, I'm starting to pay attention that we might be, you know, with the news. And again, I'm always skeptical about what I hear out of China. You know, I've argued this for 12, 13 years with people. I'm watching very closely just to see what's going on, because you do hear some bad things, you know, about what's happening in the Chinese economy. And if that's the case, commodity prices may come under pressure as some of the lenders call the security, call the collateral, and start pushing it on the market in order to raise some cash to secure the loans.
Speaking of the commodity market potentially going under more pressure, the idea of commodity indices now in some sense at all-time lows from a real-term sense. Do you see any potential for the investment asset class and commodities as being bullish from a contrarian perspective?
Yeah, you know, I've been I think that the agricultural sector is a good sector. to be in, because as we've talked about before, we have massive crops around the world. You know, we got South America, Latin America is producing soybeans and corn and now even wheat. And Europe has had big wheat crops, and Ukraine has had a good wheat crop, and France, you know, so there's a lot of grain in the world, but yet prices, while way off their highs made a few years ago, are still relatively strong. I mean, I'm looking at soybeans at $9.75. Well, let's talk in real numbers here. It's $9.75, which is the low of the last 8 years, is about, let's say, $8.50, okay? It's just for argument's sake.
Yeah.
But if I go back, if I go back, Richard, to 2001, soybeans were $4.50.
Yeah.
1999. You know, yeah. So we've seen these numbers. The Chinese demand situation has bent that curve upward, the global food curve, dramatically. And even though we get record production, we have relatively, historically, very strong prices.
Yeah.
You know, I just showed you, 2001, we were at $4.50.
Yeah.
We have record production, and our lows have been $8.50 over the last 3 years, and we're trading at $9.60 right now. And, you know, I just drove home through that part of the country, and I saw the rain and snow damage. So we've had a little bit of a rally this week in the agricultural products, wheat, corn, and beans. But this is something to pay attention to. I like it, you know, and I was looking at Bunge Grain today, which is whatever, and it's down dramatically because their earnings were low. We've seen this. But, you know, I don't advise people to rush in, but I always advise people, go do your own work, take a look, and see if there's an opportunity for you. Bunge's down 14-15% today. Archer Daniels been down because as grain prices soften, although they're really not softening, but the earnings have been down, and there's a massive amount of grain to be moved. But the one thing that we're sure of is that China and India need grain. End of story. So, and as their income levels move up, agricultural products, higher protein products are in demand. And that's why there seems to be an elevated floor for some ag prices. So it's what I'm paying attention to. I think there's a lot of relative, you know, there's a lot to it. And I think, you know, you can selectively choose. The great thing about the commodity market, unlike a lot of financial markets that are manipulated, farmers and miners, they react to price. So when copper prices go up, you get more mining done. When gold prices go up, you get more mining done. When ag prices go up, farmers plant more crop. As we see, we're getting record crops every year. The markets do work.
Yeah. Well, we've run out of time today. Great insight, Ira, as always. And just wondering if you could please relate to our listeners how they can learn more about your work.
If you go to Ira Harris, YRAHARRIS.com, and you can go, one of the first things that'll pop up is Notes from Underground. That's the blog I write in tribute to the great Fyodor Dostoevsky. And for anybody who's read Notes from Underground, they'll understand why. And go there, and you can sign up. I would advise you go read old blogs. Richard was kind enough to read one of my recent ones. I used to write 4 or 5 days a week, but honestly, there's not much in the world to write about. As the VIX goes down, there's less, I hate just regurgitating old stuff. Every once in a while, I'll reissue an old one. But go to Notes on the Ground. You can sign up. It comes to you. It's free. I invite constructive discourse. It's important. You'll see that if you need a platform to speak some political views, it's the wrong blog to read. But if you really want to get involved in some interesting global financial, because it's all about global macro. Every once in a while, I'll dig down into more micro stuff, but very unusual. I like to look at the world and see it because I see it through a vision of global cash flows. So if that's what you're looking for, it's, again, the price is right, and you can determine whether it has any value for it, and hopefully you'll become part of a community. I think I have about 3,000 regular readers. It's done on WordPress, and I always post the FRA podcast, which my readerships love. I get a lot of great feedback from it. So you guys keep doing the good work, and hope, and I know the world won't disappoint us by they'll keep giving us opportunities. I know that. So we have to find them. That's our job.
Great. Yeah, we thank you very much on that. And yes, we highly recommend that blog. We'll put a link also in the abstract that we write up on this podcast for everybody.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.